Hello, Internet. My name is Walter C.A.D. Svedchuk, and welcome back to another special edition of the Final Cut Podcast presented by the Rough Drafts Podcast Network. Each week, me and my illustrious co-host, we each watch movies, two movies that we've never seen before, and we discuss them with each other, what we like, what we didn't like, what was a waste of our time. That's not actually the premise of Final Cut itself, but that is the premise for the introduction to Final Cut, a podcast where we both watch the same movie and then discuss it. But this week, we also watched two movies each. One that we're going to talk about together, one that the other person didn't see. And of course, when I say we, an illustrious co-host, I, of course, mean my good friend, Chase Wassenaar. Chase, how are you doing today?
I mean, I'm doing great. There was a moment there where I was a little afraid that I'd walked into the wrong podcast, but I'm glad that we sorted this out. You know, it would be interesting to do an episode of this show where we each talked about a different film for a little bit. But I am glad at least that I get to bring my pick for the week to the masses, because while you have not expressed any interest in it, I believe that the folks at home should be very interested in the film I'm excited to talk about. So,
well, I do think we tried to do this two episodes ago with the J-Lo movie, but I, instead of watching another movie, read from a Reddit post. So,
that's true.
And performed small appliance repair on my Roomba. So it didn't quite work out. It didn't quite work out the way that we had intended. But Chase, yeah, it is weird. You know, you say, oh, I didn't really express much interest in it. It's like, well, because it feels like more like it would have been like a guilty pleasure thing, like something I would have watched, but then never admitted to anyone that I watched. And it's because Zendaya is fucking gorgeous. So Chase, how was Challengers?
Challengers was great, man. Look, how do you feel about thruples?
I don't have any opinions.
Any, on thruples. No opinion on thruples. Like, no. Yeah, how about bisexual tension?
I mean, bisexual tension is something. It is something that exists quite often in media. So, hey, you know, I'm down.
I mean, look, here's the offer I can make for you. If you enjoy either of those things, you're going to love Challengers. This is a film that I would describe as a thesis statement fulfilled. The thesis of this film, made clear very early, is that tennis is like a relationship. Good tennis happens when two players go back and forth and grow to understand each other through the tennis that is being played. And this is a film that is theoretically built around tennis. Zendaya's character, Tashi Duncan, being this women's tennis prodigy who gets injured early on in her career. She ends up marrying one of these two very close friends who have kind of a friendly rivalry that turns into a very not friendly rivalry, and also some very clear sexual tension that is palpable throughout the film. And that Zendaya likes to tease and play around with at various points of the film. And this dynamic ends up playing itself out over all of these kind of vignettes. It's a very, I would say the qualm of my, when it comes to my review of it, as I have one, is that it's told in a very non-linear format. You know, you'll cut to the present day, which is the two of them, Patrick Zweig and Art Donaldson, these two very close friends having this back and forth match that is meant to be like the symbolic culmination of everything that the film is trying to build. And we keep flashing back to various moments that got us to this place. I don't know that back and forth really added to the film, though it certainly does a good job of replicating the back and forth of a tennis match, right? There's that, everything in this film is framed around that core thesis. And even if I think some of the timing stuff wasn't ideal, because I found it to be maybe a little bit distracting rather than helpful, the acting performances are great. Trent Reznor does the soundtrack here, and the soundtrack is a banger throughout. there are some cinematography choices that are very interesting. Some of them land better for me than others, but all of them are trying to build towards a dynamic experience that plays into making tennis as interesting to watch as possible. But this is all about the relationship dynamics. It's about how Zendaya's character fluctuates back and forth between these two men at various points in their career, the things that turn her off to these men and the things that keep them bound together. And the final shot is this peak culmination of the idea of tennis as a relationship, as these two once friends, now bitter rivals, finally reconcile with Zendaya's character popping off in the background. It's really, really well executed. I give it a 9 out of 10. I had a wonderful time with this film. I highly recommend it. If you're worried that the kind of bisexual teasing that happened during the trailers is just bait, I can assure you it is not. If you want to watch Zendaya and some attractive male actors with a whole bunch of sexual tension and tennis shenanigans, you're never going to do better than this. Really well done film.
I do feel like adding the tennis shenanigans to it kind of does put it in its own little box that nothing else would touch. How many movies is Zendaya going to be in where tennis is involved? Probably only one.
But it
sounds like maybe it should be more.
I mean, I would say that, again, tennis exists to fulfill a thesis statement, right? It has to be tennis because of the way in which tennis ties into the theme of relationships and the back and forth as two people are constantly trying to keep up with and at times surpass the other. And the idea of what it means to play a true tennis game matches the idea of what it means to find a true relationship, true emotional vulnerability being matched by this synchronicity on the court. The tennis is not an afterthought the way I kind of framed it there, but it would also be remiss of me to not mention it given how firmly the theme of the film is built around it. So that's why I kind of framed it that way, but let's be real. This is relationships and thruples and bisexual tension and the things that drive people in good times and bad explored brilliantly.
Fantastic. Well, I am glad you had such a lovely time with it. And, you know, leaving that with a 9, I think maybe we should just get into our actual movie.
Real
reason.
You didn't see a film that you thought might be worth talking about real quick? There wasn't a film that perhaps you tried to get me to see and drag me down into the abyss with you?
No, absolutely not. I definitely did not go to a movie theater and watch Civil War. I definitely didn't do that. That was not a thing that happened. Alex Garland definitely doesn't owe me a $30 refund for wasting two of my hours. And we could just leave it. No, I mean I did. All those things that I just said were true. I went and saw Civil War. Alex Garland does owe me $30 for wasting just under 2 hours of my time. Pat yourself on the back, Chase. I should have fucking listened to you. I get it. You were right. I was wrong. The apolitical Civil War movie was fucking apolitical. I will say my partner, I don't want to say that they enjoyed it, but they did say like, oh yeah, like it's a warning, which I love them dearly. I would disagree. I don't think it's a warning. I think it is a romanticized version of a warning. I truly believe, not even talking about the actual like contents of the film, I truly believe that Alex Garland one night had a very vivid dream of DC burning. And he woke up and he wrote it in his dream journal. And then like a couple days later, he's going back looking for ideas. And he was like, oh, I'm going to make a movie where DC gets destroyed by someone, right? Someone, right? We're gonna make Red Dawn, whatever, you know? And then I think a couple nights later, he had another dream, and he was remembering being a childhood boy on his papa's knee. And his papa's, you know, kind of bouncing him up and down. And he goes, "Now, son, what do you want to be when you grow up?" And he's looking out, and he's watching Walter Cronkite or something. He's like, "I want to be a journalist, Daddy." And he's like, "What if you were a photojournalist, son?" Because his father, like, you know, is really into cameras or something, right? And he goes, "Okay, Daddy, I'll be a photojournalist. I want to be a war journalist." And then he wakes up. He's like, "Oh my God, that's a great idea." And he writes in his dream journal. And then he comes back a couple days later because he needs something else to go with DC burning. He's like, "I fucking got it. I'll make a movie about a war journalist and DC is burning. How do I get to DC burning? Fuck it. The world is falling apart right now. Let's say America has a civil war." It would have been nice to see that civil war other than the last like 10 minutes of the film. There's also Kirsten Dunst is in it.
Yeah,
she's like the main character. She apparently is like the best war journalist ever, like the best photojournalist ever, because they said it. She has an admirer. Her name's Jessie. That hitches a ride with them as they're going to go to DC to interview Nick Offerman, who my partner timed it is in this film for 54 seconds. Mm-hmm. Couldn't tell that based on the trailer. You would have thought he would have been like a huge part of it. 54 seconds. They used the stopwatch on their phone for it. But yeah, Jesse like hitches a ride with them to go. And I just want to say Jesse is 23. It is explicitly stated that Jesse is 23. Don't mind the fact she looks like she's like 14. Ignore that. She's definitely 23. And the other male character in the movie is named Joel. And they do a lot of the like Joel and Jesse like kind of hunched over, like sneaking around places as Jesse's like taking photos. It's not to try and remind you of Last of Us. I promise. It's not to try to remind you of Last of Us. This is fucking garbage. I can't talk about the film because there's nothing to fucking talk about, right? It's this dude was like, "I have some ideas. Let me throw them down on paper and like maybe make something cool." And like, it's not cool. It doesn't say anything. It tries to have these like super profound moments. Like everybody's seen in the trailer with Jesse Plemons being like, "Yeah, what kind of American are you?" Like, oh yeah, that's really fucking profound in, you know, 2024. Way to fucking go, Alex Garland. You're so prophetic. You're such, this is a dude that literally smokes his own farts.
Yeah. I mean, again, if you're calling a movie like Civil War apolitical on purpose, I really feel like you've missed the mark on why you should do a Civil War film. I will say my roommate went to see it, and his argument that was, you know, he wasn't a huge fan of the film, but he said, you know, if people go expecting a Civil War film and what they get is a film that ultimately boils down to war is bad, there are worse things that you can do. I don't find that hugely convincing to me, just because there are a lot of films that say war is bad.
I don't even think it says that. I genuinely don't think this film says fucking anything.
I think this is a
styrofoam packing peanut.
My favorite take on the film, beyond yours, because that was very good, was Jake Hanrahan, who is a conflict journalist, saying, "I think actively avoiding the sorts of war reporters portrayed in Civil War is what's kept me alive and sane whilst reporting from the front lines for 10 years. There are a lot of them that are really that reckless and pompous. That bit they got right." The film is just about whatever. I don't really know what it's meant to be about, but it's not about a civil war. The end from urban combat point of view is completely absurd and stupid. But by that point, I was kind of like, who cares? I'll send this to you to read in your own time, because I think you'll find it satisfying.
Yeah. The ending, which is finally like the Western states, whatever the fuck they're called, the Western forces, finally getting to like DC and like driving through DC and going like four blocks, it doesn't mean anything. It's like, oh Yay, the action film. Of course, the president is hiding in the Oval Office under his desk, and the last words he says, "Don't let them kill me." Like, I don't know what made me roll my eyes more, that or the moment where Jesse asks Kristen Dunst's character, Lee, if, would you take a photo of me when I get killed? And she's like, what do you think? And then, like, when Lee dies, Jesse takes a photo of her. It's like, that's fucking poetry. That's, I can't put enough sarcasm in my voice to show how much fucking poetry this is.
It's just like with everyone's favorite film, Madame Web. They set it up earlier, which means when you pay it off, it's good.
I'm going to say something, and I know, Chase, you're going to admonish me for this. If Alex Garland had any respect for the artistry of cinema, he would swallow a pistol tonight. That is how much disdain I have for this fucking film.
I would like to say on the record, I do not co-sign that opinion.
That's fine. That's fine. I get it. It's extreme.
I will say I'm a little bummed that this is the second best performing movie at the box office that A24 has ever had. This was wildly
successful.
Because
they suckered people like me into it.
Yeah.
To be like, maybe it does say something. And I didn't listen to my friend who clearly knew better. And it doesn't say anything. It's nothing. It's not even a blank canvas that could have been made better. It is an abomination and never should have seen the light of day.
But did it look pretty?
There were like one or two scenes that I do think the cinematography was very nice. I'm not going to give Alex Garland any credit for that. So congratulations, the J-Lo film. You're now a -9 and this is a -10.
We did it. We did it, J-Lo. Congratulations.
You are not the worst movie I've seen this year.
Really, the lesson here is that Civil War needed a zodiacal council. That would have brought it all together.
It definitely needed that rapper that has tattoos on his face that I forget
his name.
Post Malone. It definitely needed Post Malone. I'll give it that.
There we go.
But you know, Chase, a movie that doesn't need Post Malone or a zodiacal council, Dev Patel's Monkey Man, the movie that we're actually here to talk about. I'm going to go a little bit quicker here on the intro to actually get us into the meat of this film. But what were your expectations going into Monkey Man? Because I seem to remember when we were kind of coming up with some of the films to watch here going, you know, spring into early summer, I had brought up Monkey Man and you were like, Monkey Man, what's that? You Googled it and immediately were like, yes, I'm in. So what were your expectations?
Yeah, I mean, look, Dev Patel is one of the most interesting actors that's out there right now, right? He is inherently charismatic every time he is on screen. I haven't always loved every film that he's in, but I've appreciated whenever he's been in it, right? Like, his acting performance was the one saving grace of The Green Knight, a film I otherwise detested. He's just inherently an interesting guy. And so when you told me, hey, Dev Patel, this is his directorial debut, and oh, by the way, he got Jordan Peele's company to produce it, I'm like, okay, I'm interested. These are a lot of talented people with interesting approaches towards art and artistry coming together to make something that feels like, you know, and I hope this doesn't come off as a callous way to say this, but, you know, an Indian-flavored version of John Wick, right? That kind of action movie, more grounded than the kind of Bollywood films that we've seen or the RRR is not Bollywood. I'm trying to remember the language. In either case, the idea that, you know, obviously there are a lot of Indian forms of media and whatnot. This is very different than that. It is more American style, but certainly has, you know, it takes place in India. It has a background that Dev Patel is clearly very connected to and is based on a mythology that is interesting to explore. And so I was in. I was interested in seeing where it would go. And we got a very interesting film. It is by no means a perfect film, but it is definitely a very interesting film and one that I'm excited to talk about today.
RRR is from Tollywood, since it's a Telugu film.
Thank you. Thank you.
It is Tollywood. I really think I had seen somebody on Twitter or something share, you know, the initial trailer or whatever. And I think, you know, calling it the an Indian John Wick or whatever. I've seen a couple different interviews where Patel approaches it differently. Some he's like very like, yeah, that's exactly what I was going for. And others he tries to like back off of that a little bit. But like to me, that sold it, right? Because I've seen John Wick. John Wick is fucking awesome. I've seen Jawan, which I also kind of thought was like a Bollywood John Wick. That movie was fucking awesome. So when you bring up, as you said, a very captivating actor that is looking to kind of, you know, make his mark here as making an action movie written for a younger version of him, right? That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to write one of these revenge action movies that have become extremely popular since John Wick 1. But for him, for a younger version of him. And I'm like, cool, I'm ready to ride that, right? And I even thought this was going to be a little bit more Bollywood than it ended up being, right? This is not a Bollywood film at all. There is no song, dancing, anything like that. This, I think, is an Indian man and director writing a movie where the cast is predominantly Indian. But it is a very kind of Western or, you know, martial arts, Japanese Western kind of inspired action movie. And it took one trailer. And I was like, yeah, I'm fucking sold. I don't know. I don't care. And especially coming off some of the dregs of movies we had been watching, I was like, this is right up my alley. And I don't think it disappointed to me. We'll get to the ratings at the end, but the big thing I though think for us, Chase, is that the selling point besides this being John Wick but Indian, which does feel kind of reductive, but it's Dev Patel. He is the one selling this, right? It is his passion and his interviews talking about it. It is the fact that he is the leading man. It is that he is the director of this, as you said, a feature film directorial debut for him. So there seems like there's two different aspects to Dev Patel in this film. There is Dev Patel, the actor, and then there is Dev Patel, the director. Which one would you like to start with? Would you like to start with the actor or the director?
I mean, we can start with the director because I think it's the more interesting dynamic throughout this film. This is a film in which Dev Patel has openly talked about struggling with a budget. This film had a budget of $10 million, and I think you can feel it in the first third of the film. From my understanding, he's talked about having to film some scenes on an iPhone because they simply did not have the money to rent the highest quality cameras for the entirety of the production process. And I think you can tell. And it's interesting to see how Dev Patel tried to account for that, right? You know, his character in the early parts of the film is not very confident in himself, right? He has a clear goal. He would like to get revenge over the person who was responsible for burning down his forest village and the death of his mom that we later get to see is quite detailed and torturous. But he is still very unsure of himself. He hasn't built up a lot of skills beyond just being angry and willing to fight. And endurance can only get you so far. It's why his first attempt fails. And the entire time that you're seeing that initial sequence, you're seeing a lot of quick cuts. You're seeing a lot of blur. You're seeing a lot of hectic action. And the camera doesn't hold on shots the way that you would like it to in order to get the maximum effect. Now, whether that is fully thematic a choice or if that is covering for production difficulties and then tying it into larger themes, I lean more towards the latter than the former. But it is a little jarring, admittedly. It makes it difficult to fully engage with the first half of the film, I would say. But there is a point at which it feels like Dev Patel figures out the film that he's making and the way in which he wants to shoot it. And the last, I would say, 30 minutes to an hour of this film are pretty darn perfect when it comes to shooting those same action shots. The camera work is a lot more assured. They hold on shots that have this visceral nature to it. We see the brutality of some of these action sequences, right? Things that even John Wick has shied away from doing. There were a couple people in a couple rows behind me who were talking about this being the most violent film they've ever seen. And I think you can make a good argument for that, especially in the closing sequence. If you're not someone who likes like the body horror kind of films, it is certainly incredibly visceral, and it understands how to make each of those moments land. And that's difficult, right? I mean, we saw Silent Night, a film that neither of us loved because I think a lot of the writing let it down, but it was also, from a cinematography perspective, not capable of landing all of the punches it clearly wanted to land. And I would argue that the first half of this film doesn't land every punch that it wants to land. But by the end of it, Dev Patel has figured it out. He understands what it takes to make each of those shots matter. And it left me feeling like there was some potential left on the table here that wasn't fully fulfilled, but also like I cannot wait for his second directorial film, because I think he learned a lot from this movie, and you could see it by the end of this film, and I think we're going to see it even more in whatever his next project is.
I think that that is actually very interesting that you bring this up in this manner, right? When you think about the one, I didn't know any of the budgetary issues, right? I had no idea that there were things like that behind it, but the kind of balance as the film gets better does make a lot of sense, right? It is kind of interesting, and I thought that was more of a specific, you know, cinematographic choice to sort of match the uncertainty and the issues that Dev Patel's character, that Kid is going through, right? That there is this uncertainty that sequence, that first fight sequence and the race away all makes a lot of sense, that it is rough, that it is choppy, that, you know, he can't drive the tricycle, I forget what they're actually called, but he can't drive it very well, and he's just trying to get out, and it's very haphazard, and realizes he bit off more than he could chew, and he's just doing anything he can to escape and get away and flee. I thought that was a design choice. So, you know, perhaps, yeah, maybe it is. It's that they didn't have the budget for it. They had to use, like you said, an iPhone camera and go from there. You bringing up the one of the most violent films that people have seen, it did give me Tarantino vibes at points. And I think that is something else that you're kind of plucking at. It is clear that Patel is very inspired by a number of directors or a number of genres, right? It is clear there is the John Wick, Chad Stahelski, you know, idea. That is what prompted this idea from here, right? It is very clear that then is also inspired by John Woo and Crouching Tiger and Hidden Dragon, like these traditional revenge martial arts movies that, you know, date back and back and back. And then the ultra violence of it does feel, like I said, very Tarantino-esque, very, I would even say, kind of like modern horror, like you said, with the body horror and just kind of the gore porn, right? And it does feel like as the movie is going on, he is taking all of these individual pieces and they're being very chopped up. And you're like, okay, well, I can see the John Woo inspiration here. I can see the John Wick inspiration here. I can see the Tarantino inspiration here. But it is not synchronous, right? It kind of creates this cacophony of ideas and themes. And then, as you said, he eventually finds his center. He finds his place within this, you know, Venn diagram of, you know, themes and directorial decisions and cinematography, and finds his center as Kid finds his center. And I agree, the last 45-ish minutes of that film, I'm going to say from the scene with the drum, I think, on is Patel has figured out what he is trying to say, how he is trying to say it, and projects the rest of that to the world and projects it through its acting, because it does feel like that is the moment that Kid discovers who he is, discovers what his calling is, far beyond just the revenge plot that he starts with, and understand that his revenge is actually used for some form of greater good. And while we have some criticism of the, you know, kind of the early directorial stuff of the film, I think from moment one, Patel as an actor is on fire, is sublime. I think that he is extremely capable showing off at the end, the master, you know, master of fighting, and still staying true to who he is, and rewinding all the way back to, he is kind of stumbling his way through this and figuring his way out and working up the ranks.
Definitely.
And, you know, despite the fact that he knows these things are going on, when he sees the drugs, or he sees how women are being treated, or all these things, like his sense of honor, you know, sends him to the bathroom to throw up, or sends him to the bathroom to be like infuriated by the fact that, you know, he thought he had a moment where he could have gotten his vengeance and he choked, right? He didn't do it. What did you think about the kind of the acting performance across the board of Patel?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think he's an incredible actor. I mean, it's one of the things that I always knew I was going to appreciate about his performance. And I think he sells that arc very well, right? You know, this is ultimately a story about a man who has a need for revenge but doesn't know how to pursue it, doesn't know how to become something bigger than himself, and he is forced to do so with the help of a whole bunch of trans women who help kind of save him from himself and give him that extra lease on life. It is a very powerful performance. You feel for his character the entire way through, regardless of how you feel about his methodology. And, you know, he's incredibly sympathetic. Of course, there are plenty of, you know, characters along the way who are also quite good. I think you know, Alpha, the leader of that trans woman commune, does an incredible job. You know, Rana Singh and Baba Shakti, great villain characters, do a really good job of being eminently hateable. Baba Shakti, through just being the perfect personification of corruption as a religious leader, and Rana Singh as the lackey who ensures whatever needs to get done gets done from that militaristic perspective. There's just a lot of good character work throughout, and I think that it is fantastic to see these talents get highlighted. You know, like a lot of these actors and actresses are people that I haven't seen in a lot of other films before, but I certainly would like to moving forward. So that tells me they're doing something.
And it is a breath of fresh air for representation, right? We can talk here about like action tropes, right? And some of the things that the movie touches on, and some of the things that it, shies away from. But the inclusion of like the Haraja community, right? Like, as you said, the trans women and Alpha, definitely didn't fucking see that coming. That was not something that was on my action card revenge movie bingo card. And the way that they utilize this as this sort of acceptance of who you are, right? And allowing yourself to be true to yourself. And the way that Alpha and the rest of them utilize that to help push Kid towards who he truly is, right? I won't say should be, but who he truly is. And, you know, pushes him into acceptance of his self, is really fucking cool. It is a really cool subversion of expectations and portraying the sensei, right? The guru, right? The person, the teacher.
I think there are so many times in this genre, right, where the answer for the assassin type character is to come up with a singular focus, right? To drown out everything else so that revenge can be attained. And this is a film that argues the exact opposite, that the only way for any sort of action to land is to be able to go outside of yourself through this hallucinogenic experience and confront the real systemic issues that led to this, right? You have to fight for more than just revenge against the guy who specifically, you know, killed your mom. You have to ask, well, what was the system that allowed for the order that made this happen in the first place? It's that macro thinking that actually gives him strength, along with a couple other things I want to save in my back pocket for later. It's certainly a very interesting twist on that kind of trope.
Yes, and it also doesn't fall for the romance, right? The portrayal of Sita, who is one of the prostitutes that works in this bar that Baba and Rana Singh, that they kind of operate out of, right, and they utilize kind of as their den of inequity. Right, there are numerous moments where you're like, oh, this is gonna be like a romance thing with Sita and Kid, and like it never actually becomes that, right? It's more of a just like they both are surviving, and when there is a moment of Kid potentially being wounded, Sita then finds her moment of getting her revenge against the woman that's basically enslaved her, right? That has basically forced her into this prostitution. There's also the moment with the dog where I did give a little bit of an eye roll and being like, oh, we really are going John Wick here, huh? And the usage of the dog just as a prop, right? Just to get the gun past the metal detector so he could go in for his first attempt, I think is fucking brilliant, because it is this sort of, as he said, oh, it's Indian John Wick. So that idea is planted in your head, and here comes the subversion, right? The usage of Alfonso is kind of like the lovable sidekick. Like, he doesn't actually act as a sidekick, right? He is threatened by that he's, you know, it's his rickshaw, and it's him that is in the rickshaw as Kid flees, and it was him that led Kid up the ranks, but like, Alfonso was a byproduct and was an innocent bystander of Kid's revenge. Yes. And, you know, the fact that he doesn't come into the fight at the end, right? He's not there leading the charge. But he does see Kid, you know, come back to the wrestling ring, right? The fighting ring that he starts out in the beginning of the movie, and sees Kid has changed and he finally wins, is like nice. But again, it's the subversion of sort of the sidekick goofball character.
And also a casualty of scripting changes and budget issues, because Alfonso was clearly meant to be more of a through line. Like, they have at one point a scene in which, like, the on the news channel, they're talking about the cops looking for him, and he's meant to be in danger, and nothing ever comes from that. Like, we see him once, as you said, at that fight scene where he sees Dev Patel finally get a win, and we're done. And I do not believe that was meant to be the end of his character arc. It feels like that got kind of cut to make room for other things, likely more important things. But I think that's, to me, a character that is a great example of, like, this sure was the first time Dev Patel did these things, you know? Like, just didn't quite know how to pay that one off as fully as it probably could have been.
Fair enough. And I definitely can see the, like, oh, well, yeah, he is not as important because we ran out of time and money to make him more important angle of it. Mm-hmm. I can understand. I can appreciate that. The other thing being that this is not, like, he's not a trained fighter, right? He's not a singular boogeyman assassin in the way John Wick is in, you know, the first John Wick movie, right? This is more of the, like, yeah, he's kind of learned how to fight. He knows how to, like, take care of himself, but he gets hurt, right? And even in the end, where he does have this, like, singular focus, right? He doesn't just blow through everybody and, you know, get his vengeance and walk off into the sunset, right? It is very much a John Wick 4, where every step towards his revenge costs him something, right? It hurts him. It shows that he is human, that he is not a boogeyman, that he is not, Juanaman, right? It is that he is only human, but it is his resolve and it is his spirit that is pushing him and compelling him. And I love the ending of, spoiler alert, sorry, everybody, of him getting his vengeance, but then also falling, right? And very much like John Wick 4, we have no idea. We have no idea if he's alive or dead, right? Not really.
Well, I feel like with John Wick 4, we knew he was dead until the film made enough money that he wasn't. This, I think, I agree with you, is much more ridiculous, which is to the film's credit, because it plays into this theme of what does it mean to truly die in this context, right? Especially if we are to believe in the Hindu, I don't want to say mythology, because mythology, I think, has a connotation of a religion that is not actively being practiced, and Hindu certainly is. But if you believe in that concept...
Philosophy, sure.
What it means to truly die is as much up for debate as anything that, you know, the ending presents here. And so it's... I think this does a better job of leaving that can of worms open for interpretation than John Wick 4 did before the film studio was like, but it made a lot of money though. Which I will struggle with when John Wick 5 is eventually announced, for the record. But I'll save that complaint for later, I suppose.
Well, Chase, if you want more John Wick, you can just watch The Continental with the dude from The Patriot in it.
I mean, I might. We'll see, I guess.
Mel Gibson. Mel Gibson in it.
Oh, no. Mel Gibson's...
he's the bad guy.
Well, I guess it's better that he's the bad guy. I kind of would like to not have Mel Gibson around. I feel like there are a lot of reasons we wouldn't want Mel Gibson around in 2024, but, you know... Sure.
That is fair, Chase. I know we have touched a little bit on some of the ending sequences here and how we do think that it's sort of Patel figuring out what he is trying to do with this film. Do you agree with me when I'm talking ending sequence, talking about that scene with the drums and him hitting the bag of rice, or do you think there's a different point where the movie really kind of takes off and then, you know, crescendos to the end?
Yeah, I mean, I would say even right before that, right, where we get the, like, hallucinogenic actual full breakdown of what led his character to this moment, you know? I think one of the weaknesses of the first half of the film, and again, something that in Dev Patel's next film I expect him to not fall victim to, is just constant flashbacks. And they're the kind of flashbacks where we understand the general scope almost immediately, right? Like, it's very clear something went bad here. It led to deaths of people that our character cares about, but we didn't have the full details. And so the more it flashed back in pieces, I felt like the less impactful those flashbacks were, since they didn't necessarily teach us anything new until we got the fully fledged version of the story. And once we have that, I feel like it's a weight off the film's back, right? Because now we know what it is that drives him. There are no mysteries left to be uncovered. There is only actions to be made as a result of that information coming to reality, right? And as you said, like, that's when we get the fight scene, right? Where he's beating up on the punching bag with the drums and everything. And, you know, some people could say that's a little on the nose. It seems like a pretty accelerated training montage, but whatever. We just needed a training montage. I thought that was as good as one as any out there. I'm fine with that. I think the film did get a lot better in that, from that moment on. Am I allowed to get into my asterisk now?
Yeah. So the one thing I will say is I do think the flashbacks, or what he was trying to do, that I don't think he did very well with, and I will agree with you on this, is he was trying to do the thing where it's like, oh, you show a flashback and you give some information, and then you show the same kind of flashback and you give a little bit more, and then mm-hmm. you give a little bit more, and then you give a little bit more, and then you give the whole picture, right? And it does feel like, instead of doing the same flashback and giving just a little bit more, that he didn't do that, that he kept giving different flashbacks that I know to him in his outline and his writing all make cohesive sense. And eventually when pieced together, you know, work, but you have to, if you're going to do that, you have to do the flashbacks in order, right? You can't bounce back and forth like it's tennis. Mulaney did. and like, then try to piece it together afterwards. Cause then it is just confusing. Right. Or you have to do the reverse order. You have to do the harmful thing and then slowly go back and go back to why that thing was precious. Right. So I will agree with you on that part, and I will allow you to now shit in my cornflakes, so to speak. What's the asterisk that you have with this film?
So this is something, and I don't want to take full credit for this. Siddhant Adlaka, who is a reviewer I really like, talked about this in his review for IGN to a certain extent. I think that this film goes very hard on a couple points, right? It very clearly wants to talk about corruption within the church and how that religious corruption leads to the rise of authoritarian governments and why that is a problem and how that leads to an oppressed underclass, specifically in this case, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing this, the Hegira group, the kind of transgender community that we see in this film. I really appreciate that getting highlighted and spotlighted in this. And I think that side of things is mostly well executed, though I wish we got a little bit more time with them before they came warrior badasses, you know? Like, that also would have been a cool part of a training montage if we got a little bit more fleshed out, but whatever, right? It's a fun moment. They're great characters. I like that they're involved here. But the thing that's frustrating about this film to a certain extent is when it chooses to hedge its bets, right? Like, the authoritarian government that it's very much trying to emulate is Bharatiya Janata Party. Again, apologies if I mispronounce things. Modi's party, right? The current leader of India, who is absolutely a fascist and has utilized a lot of these tactics in order to prop up his own reign in India right now. He's a bad dude. There's a great series of Behind the Bastards on him. You should go check that out sometime. Fuck Modi. But the film originally, the colors of the flags of this fascist party were originally the same colors of the flags of Modi's political party, and they changed it because they were afraid that it would get the movie censored in India. Spoiler alert, it ended up getting censored in India anyway. Technically, there was like a FOIA request, like India's version of a FOIA request on it, and the government said that they did not need to disclose that information, which is about as much confirmation as we're going to get. Feels like it'd be a very easy FOIA request to answer if the answer was, we were cool with this movie airing. And we know that Modi and his government have a history of attacking actors and directors and people who speak out too openly against the government. So to a certain extent, I get it, right? Like, putting his actual flag would have been a big statement that puts everyone involved in the project in trouble. Okay. Fine. But then we get to the politician, right? The cowardly fascist politician who we see in the last sequence of the film at one point hiding behind the couch of the club room in which Dev Patel's character is feuding against the general, right? They have their final climactic fight, of which Dev Patel obviously emerges victorious, and he sees the politician. And he chooses to let him go, which goes entirely against the theme to that point that he needed to attack something larger than himself, right? Systemically, there is no one more dangerous than the actual fascist politician who is pushing all of the policies that are putting the people you care about in danger. Like, that's the point that you were originally making. And again, I feel like he hedged because killing a politician would have put the film in real danger, but it reads very hollow as a result, right? The idea that he's just allowed to go off scot-free means that no matter how you read the end of the film, whether you believe that our monkey man hero survives or dies, the politician's just going to find more yes man, right? He'll find a new head of police. He'll find a new religious leader. Fascism is going to continue to be a very palpable threat. And he didn't cut off the head of the snake. And that's a weird choice to make.
I'm going to push back on this.
Okay.
If you still have more point to make, please, by all means, finish it.
I have one more, but I'll let you go first.
I feel like I want to push back on the head of the snake. Because the movie doesn't portray that politician as the head of the snake. It portrays Baba Shakti as the head of the snake. And maybe that's my interpretation to it. And it's really I'm being misguided in the same way that Kid is, right? The monkey man is, right? And that Shakti is the one that, you know, bulldozed the village so he could build his compound, right? His religious compound, right? He's the one that put the police chief in power and helped the police chief rise, right? It is his endorsement of the politician that is the push, and his endorsement of the politician right before Diwali and utilizing Diwali and its reverence and the religiosity behind it as the election day. That seems to me what the movie is trying to say is that it's Baba Shakti that is the serpent, right? He is the one that has been pulling the strings and has been making everything run. And while I do agree, like, not killing the politician right then and there, I understand that it does have some real world kind of like implications and cowardice, you know, points of cowardice. At the end of the day, like, the politician had not done anything to Kid, right?
And we saw the whole. I'm cutting.
And that Kid's focus is on the people that he believes directly harmed him, right? I'm not gonna, you know, quibble and say that the politician's not a bad person and probably should have been stabbed right then and there, but he is focused on the chief of police, on Rana Singh, and on Baba Shakti, and if it means letting this man go so he can get to Baba Shakti, like, that's the choice he makes. Sure. And I guess that to me is it comes down to interpretation of who you think is really the, as you said, the head of the snake or the larger villain. Is it the politician that he lets escape, or is it Baba Shakti? And it seems that we are at odds on who we think is more important.
Well, I'll say two things to that. Number one, if the film did a better job of presenting that as an either-or scenario, that would be one thing. There's no real sense of urgency within the film itself that Baba Shakti is running away. He's very clearly up in a penthouse and seems very relaxed, expecting his final confrontation to happen. There's no evidence given that it is an either-or scenario. So I don't buy the idea that that was in the monkey man's head when he was making that call. The other problem is that we had a scene in which the fascist did a whole fascist speech that was very hateful and attacked the people that Dev Patel's character cares about. Like, they didn't have to have that scene, right? They chose to have that scene. They chose to have the political rally in which the fascist leader did a fascism and very clearly came after the people that he cares about, up to and including a legal decree, not a religious one, to try to kick them out of their home, right? You added that. You could have kept it to religion. You could have kept it to military and police. But he goes out of his way to point out the sins of the political state in and of itself, and then chooses not to follow through on that while following through on everything else. It's a held punch. And it's a punch he sets up and chooses not to land, which I think is different from a punch that is not set up at all. He didn't have to have the politician if he didn't want that to be a choice that our character had to make. He didn't have to have the speech. He didn't have to have the home, the enclave, getting hit by politicians trying to kick them out, right? He made it about the politics and the political leaders that have legislative power. And when you do that, you don't get to go back on that. He's part of the problem. And you choose for him not to be because it's messier for you? That's tough for me. That's tough for me to get past. It doesn't mean that our religious leader isn't a problem, but that leads to my final problem with the film's politics, which is that the only way to battle against a corrupt Hindu leader is to be a good Hindu, right? It's kind of the equivalent of a movie in which our protagonist would need to fight back against Christian fascism in the United States by becoming a Catholic. That's kind of the equivalent of where this film lands. Like, it's not about the flaws of Hinduism and the way that its religious leaders can be corrupted and easily manipulate the populace, which is something, you know, religion is an opiate of the masses, is not by any means a new criticism. It's just that he's doing it the wrong way, which is fine, but given, again, the emphasis of the film on how that religious fervor is leading to actions among the populace that are leading to hateful and divisive caste systems that are making the world a lot worse, it's hard to swallow the pill that the film's argument is, well, if it wasn't an asshole, it would be fine. None of them in isolation are wrong, right? You can have a movie against Christian fascism that has someone becoming a Christian to do it the right way, right? You can have a film in which fighting against the system involves showing kindness and leniency towards individual politicians in favor of attacking the people behind power, right? None of them in isolation is wrong, but all of them combined end up leaving me with a film that I feel like left some punches on the table, that set up those punches and chose not to land them out of fear of how an authoritarian, very censorious government would respond to it. An entirely understandable fear through which those hedges did not help the film at all. India still censored the film. India still prevented people in an election year from seeing a film that clearly had something it wanted to say on these issues. And at that point, you have to ask, was it worth it to hold back on those punches?
I think those are fair criticisms. And listen, this is why you have always been the voice of reason on these podcasts, and I'm the voice of feelings, right? I felt as if Baba Shakti was the bigger villain, and you go, well, like, actually, let's discuss this and let's point out things that you're overlooking in terms of importance. Like, and I think that pairs very well. And it's not a perfect film, right? No. We can get the scores here in a second. I'm not going to give this a 10 out of 10. It's definitely far from a perfect film, but I do think there are, you know, certain things that are easier to hand wave away and go, eh, it's a first time director, right? He's not going to get it right on his first go, right? Not everybody can be Jordan Peele, right?
Right.
You can't hit a home run every single time, but yeah, learning how to balance the nature of how is the public going to take the film, and we'll make it even slightly less broad, how like India is going to respond to this film, a film that you are, you know, you have said multiple times, like, oh, I'm making Indian John Wick. And then, you know, doing the things you thought you were supposed to make that work. And then it's still being admonished. You know, it is one of those things in this modern society where there is, you know, purity testing. Right, it's this concept of purity testing, and you know, can you still make something or have a point or you know, be supported by someone if you don't check every single checkbox, you know, or if they don't check every single checkbox you have, is I think something that each individual has to have, you know, and a discussion inside themselves. But we need to listen to other people when they mention, like, well, this person or this film or this thing didn't check this checkbox, and this is for this reason. And, you know, you might not always agree with it, but sometimes, like, it is compelling, and it causes you to think and reevaluate some of your own thoughts.
Yeah, I think there's something, like, there's an inherent defensiveness, I think, that sometimes people can feel. And I'm not saying you specifically, but I saw this in the comments when Siddhanta Adlaka, the guy whose review made me think about these things in a different way, I think a lot of people struggle with the difference between thing bad and thing exist, right? These problems in no way prevent the film from being good at what it's trying to be, we should just ask ourselves the questions of, well, why isn't it the thing that it felt like it wanted to be, right? Like, we can acknowledge the shots that it lands correctly, right? Again, the Hijira representation is awesome. I think the shots of the caste system, you know, there's some critics who pointed out, it was a lot sharper than I think a lot of people expected going in, because that's kind of been a topic that a lot of Indian filmmakers have been very shy about addressing because of the exact same dynamics that we talked about. It's not like this film doesn't throw any punches. It throws quite a few, which is why I believe it is worth talking about the punches it chooses not to throw. Not because it damns the film, because it doesn't. I still really liked Monkey Man, but because understanding why those other punches weren't thrown and contextualizing it with the current state of India's fascist government, I think is really important to the larger conversation about films of this genre and what are the kinds of biases that are intrinsically going to be there in films that are trying to tell these stories moving forward. Because Dev Patel got to do this from the safety of the United States, right? Imagine being a Bollywood creator and knowing how the government has actively attacked not only individual actors and directors in the past, but these actors and directors' families, right? We should be aware of these things. We should acknowledge them. It doesn't mean that the people behind the film are bad. It just means that this dynamic exists. And both things can be true.
And hopefully it is something that Dev learns for his next film or films or sequel to Monkey Man or whatever else he makes. Chase, at the end of the day, like we always do on this podcast, what are your ultimate final thoughts and your final score?
Yeah, I do feel like at the end of the day, putting aside all of the thematic quibbles that I had with it, my number one thing is just that the early half of this film isn't nearly as sharp as the second half of the film. It feels like a film that finds itself. And whether you believe it's because Dev Patel is new at this, or you believe that there were production concerns that held it back, it is impossible to judge this film without acknowledging that those problems are there. So I'm going to give it a 7.5 out of 10. I believe, you know, I don't like doing half points. Historically, I've tried not to do half points because we're on a 10-point scale. I'm going to say 7. I'm going to say a 7 out of 10 because the back half of this film is fantastic, and I think it does a lot of things really well. The last 30 to 45 minutes are incredible, but I think the first half of the film and the pacing issues that it has are things that are hard to look past when judging this film in isolation. But man, oh man, do I love Dev Patel as an actor. And I am really excited for film number 2. Whatever that film is, I am in. Because I feel like Dev Patel really learned over the course of this film. And whatever qualms I had about the first half, I feel pretty confident, aren't going to come up again. And I'm glad that given its limited budget, it ended up doing very well comparatively. And I hope that that enables him and, you know, the Monkey Paw production studio that Jordan Peele has to continue to do great work.
I'm finally glad I get to watch something that has Jordan Peele's name on it. You know, I know it's going to be a blind spot for me long term because he does horror and I don't like horror. Walter does not watch horror movies. He does not like them at all. Mm-hmm. Weird. This is a Dev Patel movie, not a Jordan Peele movie. But I do feel there is something that is Monkey Paw-esque about this film, just from some of the trailers that I've seen of you know, the other Jordan Peele movies, right? There does feel like there is a bit of a shine to this that is coming from Jordan Peele. Listen, it's an 8 out of 10 for me. It is a great action film. And I think that the subversions of some of the tropes that it does caught me off guard in the best way possible. I again am going to go back to the usage of the Haraja community and you know, shedding some light on them and the representation that they are allowing them in this film. I have to give them a lot of credit for. It really caught me off guard in the best way possible. I do think that final sequence, you know, particularly the montage sequence, I think is just absolutely fantastic. And then the fight sequence showing so much growth in Kid and, you know, his usage of the people that have helped him, allowing them to help him, relying on them. And then, you know, ultimately getting his revenge and giving us that kind of that hanging thread of, is he alive? Is he dead? Can I make a monkey man too? Because this did so good. Or do I have to make something else? Understand some of the criticisms of it. Definitely do understand that the beginning of the film is rough, but this is a feature film debut for Dev Patel as a director. And if he can capture a little bit more of the charisma that he has on camera and can place it behind camera, he is probably going to shine just as bright as Jordan Peele does in the years to come. So I am very excited to see what else comes out of Dev Patel as a director. Just like I'm sure all of you at home are really excited to see what else comes out of the Rough Drafts Podcast Network, whether you listen to just Final Cut or to the gaming show as well. If you would like to discuss Monkey Man, if you would like to discuss perhaps another revenge movie that we should potentially watch, another action movie, a Bollywood film, a Jordan Peele movie, anything, Chase, where can the good folks at home find you?
You can find me at Chase Wassenaar on bsky.social. Also technically on Twitter, though I am trying to spend less time there because, you know, nightmare world and all that. But yeah, I'd love to hear from y'all. And of course, come back next Monday. Every Monday we're not doing this. We're doing the Steam Cleaners podcast, which is where we talk about two games that neither of us have. The other one has not played. We get to share our thoughts and feelings on that. It's two different games every week, and I think there's a lot of fun there, so definitely go check that out if that's the kind of thing that sounds fun for you.
Except the sometimes where we play the exact same game and then talk about it. That has happened on occasion over
what?
There. On occasion. It didn't happen this upcoming week, I promise you that. That being said, as always, you can follow me at C80s_LOL over on Twitter, where the good Lord Jack says everyone should go because Blue Sky is just less Twitter, apparently. I don't know. I don't know what he actually said. I'm also on Blue Sky at C80s.bsky.social. Chase, you promised me after watching Dune Part 2, Madam Web, and the fucking J-Lo film, we were going to get some good action movies. And I've gotten not one. I've gotten two good action movies so far. Do you think we can get a third one under our belt? Do you think we can go 3 for 3 here with a Guy Ritchie film?
Why not?
Well, until next time, goodbye, Internet.